Thank you, everyone, for joining us on another episode of Investing in Real Estate. I am Clayton Morris. I am so excited to have you here today because this show is all about buy and hold real estate. We don't talk about much else. We're just talking about investing in buy and hold real estate and changing our lives through passive income. I'm thrilled today because I've heard about this individual for a number of years through a mutual friend of ours who, in conversations, this individual would come up often. He would say, "This is the guy that does it well. He's really smart with his buy and hold investments. This is the guy we should model ourselves after going forward." And as young guys getting started in real estate investing, you know, you're always looking for guidance. You're always looking for a path that has been blazed before you. And that's what today's episode is all about. My guest is Kim Miller. And Kim has over, I think, 140 different rental properties across the country. He's been investing since the early 1980s, and he knows a thing or two about buy and hold investing. He's seen ups and downs in the market, and we're going to dive into it today on the show. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, it's a real treat to have you here. So, Kim, I was talking to a mutual friend of ours that introduced me to you, and he's always held you in such high regard. You know, we hear about these other real estate investors out there, I guess. You know, we know some big names in the real estate investing world, right? You hear the names of like people like Robert Kiyosaki and others. You know, I'm sure most of my audience probably has never heard of Kim Miller, right? You're not out there. You're not on billboards. You haven't written books, but you've just quietly been investing over the years and really building up a fortune for yourself. How did you get started?
Well, I got started actually in the building industry with my father. We built apartment buildings, and that was okay for a while, but I decided it was a lot easier just to buy houses that were already built.
So instead of building them yourself, you're just like, well, there's houses that other people built. Why should I do it?
Yes, it was a lot easier than building them.
So there's a lot to unpack there. You're not going to get off that easy. So your dad, you grew up as a young age sort of seeing your dad do this. What kind of an impact did that have on you?
Well, he was just in the building industry. He was building apartment buildings, and I worked with him. And then when we started working together, we started keeping them and not reselling them, but just keeping them and renting them. He didn't get involved with buying the single family houses like I did. That was pretty much on my own that I started doing that.
Okay. So when did you start buying your first, you know, your first individual homes? When you started maybe break off from what your dad was doing and you were going to go out on your own?
Most of the activity in single family homes has been since about 1998, 99. That's when I purchased, most of the homes. I dabbled in it before that, but since then is when I really got involved heavily.
All right. So I want to get specific now. We have a lot of investors who are just getting started for the first time. They're trying to build their roadmap, and it may be difficult for you now in 2016 to kind of look back and maybe see that roadmap. But when you were a young guy getting started doing this, what did you do? What was the roadmap? What was the blueprint? Take me through this process.
Well, I saw that there were houses that presented opportunities, houses that were in foreclosure, houses that people didn't want, and I targeted those.
Okay, let me back up again. How did you target them? And where did you find these properties?
Well, there's various services that you can subscribe to get lists of foreclosures in your town. And you can knock on their doors, or you can drive around and look at them. You can send them letters, direct mail, or you can go to the foreclosure auctions and buy them right there. But you need a lot of cash to do that.
So did you have a lot of cash when you were starting out?
No, I didn't. I started out just buying houses that I could find financing that was already there, like taking over loans subject to. But very soon I did get a little bit of cash, and then I started buying them at the foreclosure auctions. And then I would refinance them and get my money back and go buy another one. And that was my game plan for a long time until the financing dried up. About 2008, I couldn't get financing any longer because the sale on the secondary market of loans was shut down if you had more than 10 in your name. And so I had to find alternative sources of financing instead of going back to the bank for my refinances.
So financing in the beginning. So take me through that process, working with the local banks. You would acquire a house that, you know, was in foreclosure. Did it need work, or was it, you know, just sort of paint carpet kind of work?
They ran the gamut. Some were a wreck and they needed a lot of work. Others were practically move-in ready. You can find all types. And so I would buy both, you know, the fixer-uppers and the ones in perfect shape. It didn't matter to me. I just added the numbers up, and whatever made sense is what I would do.
And did you find a lot of pushback from the banks at that point, or were they pretty open to working with you if the house was a total wreck? Give me an example one. If you had one that was a total wreck, what did that process look like?
Well, I would make a detailed list of the work it needed, and I would hire all the different trades to go in and do all the work. I wouldn't go to the bank to refinance it until the house was in very nice condition, you know, all repaired, and I had a good tenant in it, and I could show the bank a nice product that was, you know, in good condition and had a good tenant. I wouldn't dream of taking a house that was in bad need of repair to a lender and say, I want to borrow on this one. It's much better to take them a house that is in good condition and has a good tenant.
And so they're much more amenable when they see that. And I want our listeners to pay attention to this, because this is what a lot of my investors do, is, you know, buy their properties, buy four or five of them, and then pull the cash right back out of those properties. Do you find it easier to work with the banks on the back end of a deal? That is to say, after it's been rehabbed and after you've proven that there's rent, there's like consistent rent flow in the property.
Absolutely. It's not projected rents. It's actual rent at that point. And that's very important. It'll make your life a lot easier borrowing when you've got a stabilized property.
You own properties in multiple towns. Is that right?
Well, basically two areas, Southern California and Los Angeles County, and Southern Florida in St. Lucie County. Those are my two farms, if you will. Those are the areas that I've picked that I like. And those are the two areas that I live in. I live part-time in South Florida and part of the time in Southern California. So, you know, I bought houses in Texas. In fact, I still have a couple. And I bought property in other areas, you know, in Georgia, and I would not do it again. I want to stay close to where my investments are.
Okay. And what's the thought process behind staying close to where your investments are? Is it that you want to go out and drive by and see them, be there on a regular basis? How involved are you? You know, I talk about passive income, but how passive is your passive income? Or are you out there on a regular basis sort of checking in on your properties?
Well, because of the volume we have with 140 houses, I do have a large enough operation that I can afford to have employees. I have 8 or 10 employees. And, of course, they manage some apartments we have as well. So it's not just the 140 houses. And I do get involved. I manage the managers more or less, because I have about 3 or 4 different managers, and they have some people working under them, some maintenance men. And the time that I spend managing the managers is probably 3 or 4 hours a week, maybe something like that. It varies, but if I had to average it out, 3 or 4 hours a week. The main thing is that I'm reachable by phone or by email almost all the time, because most of what I do is decision making. A manager will say, well, should we paint this house or not? Should we rent to this tenant or not? And most of the time they already know the answer and they don't even need to ask me. But where it's a decision that they're not sure of, then they call me, or if they have a problem, they call me. So I've been able to successfully delegate the responsibility, and that's what you have to do as you grow, as you get bigger, especially if you have your own management company. It's your own business, and so you have to be able to successfully find people, you know, screen the people that you're going to hire, and then be willing to hire and fire until you find the right ones so that you can delegate the responsibilities, because I can't stress how important it is to have good management people. Because if your management stinks, your whole investment portfolio is going to suffer terribly.
Yeah, that's what we talk about all the time. Like making sure that your property management team is doing the full background checks, criminal background checks, employment verification, checking with previous landlords to make sure they pay on time. You know, in any of my properties, we're not renting to people that have evictions. We're not renting to people that have, late payments. I mean, it's 2016. I'm curious too. We talk about this, right? In 2008, and you've been through it. I mean, you've had properties since the early 80s. You know, in 2007, 2008, anyone with a pulse could get a mortgage, right?
Right.
So if you had to rent in those eras, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008, and you had to rent, I mean, maybe there was something seriously wrong with you, or you just seriously didn't want to own a property because you were transient and you needed to move around a lot. But landlords back then, holy smokes, they were sending people around just to pick up $50 here from a tenant, $50 there. And oh, if you had five evictions on your record, yeah, we'll rent to you. No problem.
Yes.
How difficult was it for you to get through that period as a landlord?
That was a difficult period. I would say that 2009, 2010, 2011, right in through there, our rents actually went down. They didn't go down as much as the value of houses went down, but they went down significantly. And at the same time, expenses did not go down. You know, the taxes – well, the taxes might have gone down a little, but all the other expenses, insurance, utilities, repairs, none of the other stuff went down. So there was a squeeze going on. Rents were going down not only because of the rates going down, but the vacancy factor was going up. There was more vacant houses. And one of the reasons is because everybody was buying a house, like you said, with a pulse. So there was more vacancy and the rental rates went down. But at the same time, expenses continued to go up. So we saw our net income get squeezed out and go down a lot. So as far as what we did was make sure we had a good product, that we had a clean house that didn't need any repairs, that had nothing that we had to apologize for, that we had the right rental rate. Even though we had to lower rates, we lowered them so we could stay competitive with the best rental rates in town. So if you have the right price and you have the right product, and of course the advertising, you know, the sources where you advertise changed over the years. It used to be newspaper advertising, then it went to Craigslist, and then it's on to, Zillow and all the different websites. You have to stay up with what's the best ways to get the houses advertised, and of course yard signs and all that. So again, that's where your management's going to be so important, is when times are hard, when the net rental income is going down.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I want to take you through some of the process now. I received this email from one of my listeners, and he'd written this. It was Sebastian Molda. He wrote this email. He says, "Hi, Clayton. Love the podcast. It's phenomenal. I share with my circle of friends, and they're loving it too. I know you're concentrating on buy and hold investing, and I'd like to suggest a topic for newbie investors. What is your workflow to confirm what the rent will be on the property before you acquire it, besides sites like rentometer.com and Zillow? Would love to hear your suggestions." So thank you, Sebastian, for the email. I would love to get your thoughts on this, Kim. What is your criteria for sort of confirming what the rent will be on certain properties? What's your workflow?
Well, I don't personally do most of this now. I've delegated this work to my managers, but they do the same thing that I would do if I was actually doing it myself. And that is, the number one priority is to know what other homes in the area are renting for. Do surveys, call other landlords, go to real estate companies that are management companies. Zillow, you can use Zillow too. You can use Trulia and Zillow on all those websites. They're pretty good as far as the rental rates. You can check them there, but don't depend on those websites for valuations. When somebody advertises a house for rent there, I think that number is pretty accurate. You can depend on that. Of course, sometimes what people ask and what they actually accept later are two different things. So it still is a good idea to find out what people are actually paying, not just what management companies are putting out there.
Is there a good way to find out what people are paying?
Well, there's little niches you can get into. One of my managers, what she does is she has a good relationship with a local real estate office that does sales and they do rentals. And she kind of has an inside track with the manager there. They manage, I think, several hundred houses. And so she's always checking in with those people. Maybe she has lunch with them or something. And they're kind of acquaintances. And she might even call them friends. And she just kind of gets information from them as far as what they're actually renting houses for. And right now, what's being asked and what's actually the rental rate that people are actually getting is pretty close, because the rental markets are pretty tight in both of our areas, Florida and California. So you can pretty much depend on the prices that you see in the rental rates on the Zillow and Trulia now. I would say that's more subject to scrutiny when times are hard, and you know, somebody might actually pay less rent than what the landlord was looking for. But now it's pretty close.
Right, right. When you look at your – it may be hard to look at it through this sort of new investor lens, and it's 2016, so financing is in a weird place. You know, people are trying to – maybe they have a little bit of money from their 401k to invest or buy their first property. How would you advise the newbie investor who doesn't have a lot of money? What would you say to that person who wants to get started, wants to start buying rental real estate? They've been hearing about it and they know that it's one of the best investment vehicles out there. How can they get started? What's one of the things that you should do right away?
Well, if they don't have much money and they don't have much credit, if they're, you know, short on both of those items, the best thing they can find is financing. They need financing. And maybe they can't go out and get a loan, and maybe they don't even have a down payment, a normal size down payment, that is. But what they can look for is seller financing, people who are willing to carry a mortgage as a seller. Like if they own the house free and clear and they don't need all the money right now and they're willing to accept a small down payment and monthly payments. Now, there's not many people like that, and you're not going to find them on the multiple listing service. But they are out there, and I bought several houses that way over the past several years, and I find them through direct mail. Another source is existing loans that can remain there when you buy the house. In other words, subject to where the loan is in the previous owner's name. And also, there's not many people there in that situation that will agree to let you make the payments on their loan. Most people are afraid of that. But there's a few people out there, if they're about to lose the house or if they're underwater, if the loan is equal to the value and they're just thinking of walking away anyway, if you can find those people, you might be able to give them $1,000 and take over their payments. Most people are afraid of those situations because they think the banks will foreclose because of the due on sale clause. But I've never heard of any bank foreclosing because of the due on sale clause if their payments aren't current. Now, I'm not saying it hasn't happened. Maybe it has, but I've never heard of that happening. I wouldn't be afraid of it. And especially if you're only giving the seller $1,000, you don't have a lot at stake anyway. So if you can buy the house subject to the existing loan, you don't need credit and you don't need much money. So seller financing and subject to, that's where I would go if I was a new investor, if I had no money and no credit or very little of both. And I would look close to my house in my neighborhood. I would talk to my neighbors. I would walk down the street and knock on doors and get to know people. You know, right in your own neighborhood is the best place for that of all, and because those people might even know you. And if they get to know you as a person who buys houses, they might even tell you of somebody they know down the street that's in trouble that needs to sell their house or something. So close contact with your neighbors in your neighborhood and looking for loans that you can buy the house subject to the loan, and sellers who might have a free and clear house who would be willing to carry the financing for you at maybe 4 or 5%, which, by the way, is a lot more than they're going to get if they put the money in the bank. That's a good way to talk to them about it. So that's what I would do.
Now, when you structure those terms with people, that's, you know, seems like maybe some people might be scared off of like these high level ninja tricks, you know, taking over a property subject to the existing mortgage that's in place. When you're making payments, for instance, let's say Kim Miller is making payments on behalf of John Locke, who owns the house, and you're taking over payments of that property. How are you making the payments? Are they coming out of your name? Are they coming out of your LLC? And I guess that's where the concern would be, that a bank would suddenly call that note due, right?
That's a possibility, but as I said, I've never heard of that happening as long as the payments are current. The bank is not real concerned about the name that's on the check they received. They're just happy they got the check. Another source where they might find out that the sales happen is insurance, because you have to change the named insured. But there's some interesting things you can do with land trusts where you can keep the true owner more obscure to the lender, and the lender probably won't even find out. If you have the seller deed the house to a land trust which has the name of the seller, and then the seller assigns the beneficial interest in the land trust to you or your company, none of that's a public document, and it looks like on the public title that the seller still owns it. It just looks like they placed it in their own living trust. But there's a lot of little details to that, and I don't think we have time to get into all that. But it's a good strategy to use to keep the ownership confidential that you've actually bought the house.
That's great. I want to dive into some of your next level sort of tips and strategies for refinancing or snowballing the process. So somebody gets their first few properties. Where do you go next to take things to the next level? That is, you know, cash out, refinance, leveraging the properties you currently have. Give us some next level strategies for people.
Well, if you have less than 10 mortgages on your credit report that appear on your credit report, you still may be able to borrow from conventional lenders like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase. And you can go to those banks, and those are good places to go if you can qualify and don't have too many loans. Once you get to 10 loans, it doesn't matter how good your credit is, those types of lenders are not going to be able to lend to you.
Right.
So that's when the seller financing or the subject twos come in. And just in the past year, I've actually found several lenders that do now specialize in investor loans. And these are lenders that understand that you have more than 10 loans, and they are much more lenient on the qualifying as far as the income qualifying. But what they do look at is the loan to value and the cash flow on that particular property they're refinancing. And so the loan to value tends to be very low, like 50%. As opposed to, you know, 80 or 90% on a conventional loan with a bank. So these lenders are not as concerned about your qualifying and how many loans you have, but they're not going to lend you very much money on each house. So that's still difficult because you're not able to finance a very large portion of the value. But up to 10 houses, the big banks are, you know, they'll do those loans. If you can qualify, you have to go through the qualifying procedure, and they look at the cash flow on the property. And that brings me to another thing I wanted to mention, and that was when you're looking at houses to buy, an important aspect is looking at how much the rent is in relation to the value of the house or what you had to pay for the house. When I'm buying houses, and this is the way I choose areas, I look for houses where the ratio of the rent to the value is high. In other words, the rent is a larger or a smaller multiple of the rent to equal the value. And the reason for this is because it makes the cash flow so much easier, and it's easier to qualify to refinance at that point too, because your cash flow looks better. Now, I'm not saying to buy in ghettos either. I would stay away from, you know, bad neighborhoods and war zones, but find a happy medium, working class neighborhoods where the values are actually low in relation to the rent. If you go into expensive areas, even though the rent is high, it's still low in relation to the value.
Right.
So if you have bread and butter type houses that are in working class neighborhoods, you're going to have a better ratio of rent to value. That's going to make it easier to refinance and get your money back, because you can borrow more in relation to what you've paid for the house, because the rent really is high in relation to the value.
It's all math, right?
It's all math there for sure.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And that's something that I remind people of. You know, I have sort of a cutoff in my head. For me, it's about 175 or 150 to 175,000. I want to kind of get in this with you. The value of the house. So let's say you're buying the house for 150 or 175,000.
Mm-hmm.
And your rent, you know, and to me, on a single family home, that's kind of the cutoff for rent keeping up with the value. You start going up to – so let's say you have that same house. Let's just say for hypotheticals, you're renting it for $1,000 and you bought it for $175. Well, if you paid $250 for the house, your rent's not going to be like $2,300, you know, $2,300 a month. It's not going to keep up with the purchase price of that house. And to me
– the ratio is not as good as you go up in price.
Right. And so working class – which is where I own all my properties and where we do our properties in working class neighborhoods, hardworking working class neighborhoods where you can get really good value, but you're not in war zones. You're not in, you know, not in high crime areas. So that's really the key. How do you zero in on those neighborhoods? Is there some sort of tool mechanism, criteria that you look at?
Well, both of the towns that are my farms, the areas that I invest in, are pretty much those type of areas, Port St. Lucie, Florida, and Palmdale, California. And they have some common characteristics. They both of them are like bedroom communities to Los Angeles and to West Palm Beach, Florida, and Fort Lauderdale, Miami area. They're within driving distance of those larger, more expensive areas. And they have a lot of land still. There's still plenty of places to build new homes. And the homes that are built there, there's a lot of newer homes because both of those areas have grown a lot in the last 20 years. They've been a couple of the highest growth areas in the whole country. And the demographics there, you know, you can look and see where the people work. So you have to look at the demographics. And there, you can go on the internet and find the demographics of, you know, what people's incomes are, where they work, and that type of information, and then choose your area. And, you know, if you happen to live in Santa Monica, California, or some place where the values of the houses is very high, and you want to stay close to home, that's a tough choice because it's difficult to make the cash flow work in those areas.
Right. You know, I spoke to an investor today, and he said to me, he said, I love the podcast. I would love to know – I would love to dive in a little bit deeper on like LLCs and tax structure and how, you know, how do you and how do your investors structure certain things? So I know how we've started to do it, but I want to hear how you do it. You have 140 houses. You've been doing it since the early 80s. What have you found to be the best in, you know, the best tax benefits to rental real estate? How do you structure your business? And how do you, you know, when you buy a new property, are you creating a new LLC for each property? And how do you have things structured?
Well, you're asking about two things. You're asking about income tax and you're asking about liability protection, you know, from
right.
potential adversaries. As far as taxation, the best tax strategy, I believe, is don't sell. It's very simple. You just don't sell. That was my philosophy when I started, and I varied from it at times. And, you know, I've sold some stuff, and then I saw how much taxes I had to pay, not only capital gains tax, but depreciation recapture. It's terrible if you've depreciated a house 10, 15, 20 years. Not only do you pay a tax on the gain you have, but you pay a tax on all that recapture of depreciation. It's devastating. So
don't sell. I get that question all the time. Sell. People say to me, well, what if we have to sell? Like, well, you can.
Well, then you have to sell. Yeah. If you have to, you have to. But you're asking me, what is the strategy? Well, the strategy is don't sell unless you absolutely have to, because the more real estate that you can hold on to for the longer period of time and let the tenants pay off the mortgages, let the values go up, the rents go up, everything works in your favor. in real estate over time. Now, there's times when the values go down like they did, you know, in 2008, 2009. But those are aberrations. If you look at the long haul, 20, 30, 40 years, it's up. And the nice thing about it is the tenants will pay for that property while you're waiting for it to go up. So by having income property and leveraging it, you can get somebody else's money to get on the elevator, so to speak, and then ride the elevator up. You just have to, you know, be careful along the way.
Right.
So, you know, not selling is a good strategy. Another thing is if you have a Roth IRA, you can buy and sell some houses there as long as you keep them and as investments for a little while and don't do too many. You can do a few there. And any house you sell within a Roth IRA, there's no tax at all. So houses that I sell from here on are probably going to be in my Roth IRA.
That's fascinating. All right. So keeping them in your Roth IRA, I hope everyone's paying attention to that. Buy, don't sell. You know, it's so true. I hear this from people who go to RIA meetings and so forth. And, you know, it'd be some of the older guys in the room and you ask them, what are your regrets in investing? You know, what regrets do you have? What mistakes did you make? And they all look at each other and they'll say the same thing. We sold. We sold our properties. We sold some properties. It's so amazing. Yeah. That's like a common refrain.
Yeah. Hold on and master the art of management, because you're going to have the management, whether you manage it yourself or whether you have your own management company or if you find an independent management company. You've got to keep the management under control because you're in it for the long haul. It's not a get rich quick scheme. It's a long haul that takes time.
Right. Right. That's the power of hold. So LLC structure. So we talked about just the benefit of holding. Do you own things in multiple LLCs for each property? One LLC, a holding company? How do you structure things?
I don't own anything personally, so my name is not personally on any deeds that are recorded. Generally, I hold things in land trusts, so the vesting on the deed will be a trust with a trustee, and generally the beneficiary of each of those land trusts is an LLC or limited partnership as the business entity. The land trust is just there to obscure the title a little bit and keep it a little bit secretive, but it's not really a liability protection. It's more of a smokescreen. The LLC or the limited partnership as the beneficiary and your business vehicle, that's where you're going to get the liability protection, you know, the corporate veil, so to speak. And so it's a two-layered thing. Now, some people go far beyond that. They have many layers. You know, the more layers you create, the more difficult web that you create, the more difficult it would be for an adversary to come and get you. But it's a two-edged sword. If you create too many cute little companies and layers, it'll bite you in other ways, and you'll end up having to explain to escrow companies and title companies and lenders and all kinds of people why you did this, and they're trying to unravel it so you can just do business. So you can kind of shoot yourself in the foot if you complicate it too much. So, you know, having multiple entities is probably a good idea, but you don't need one for each house. You have to decide what's a realistic number, because keep in mind, each LLC or each limited partnership, you have to have a bank account with its own fees and its bank statements. You have to have a tax return and somebody has to prepare it. And, you know, there's expense there. And it just creates complication in your life. So you have to strike a happy medium and decide how much complication are you willing to accept, and how much liability, how much risk are you willing to take?
That's great.
Balance.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously different opinions, and consult with your own tax accountant and tax attorney. Do you have one sort of main LLC or holding company that you keep in a certain state for, you know, is it Florida? Is it California? Is there some area that you'd find better liability protection?
I have several LLCs and limited partnerships. I don't know, six or eight of them. And Some of them hold properties. Others do the property management. I have arrangements where the management company, which may be an LLC, manages the properties that are owned by the holding company, which might be a limited partnership. But I'm really behind both of them, but they're separate entities, one doing management, one having ownership.
I have heard – here's just a separate topic here as we wrap things up. The idea of buy until you die, the idea that, well, once you stop buying properties, you're going to start paying a lot of income tax on the rental income, right? You've got a lot of rental income, 140 properties, and you are bringing in good rental income. Do you ever foresee a situation where you wouldn't continue to buy, or is that not part of your strategy?
I haven't figured out any way that I can sell property without having to pay a huge tax. And we didn't even talk about the apartments. If I sold the apartment buildings, it'd be even huger, the tax. It'd just be tremendous, ridiculously large. So my plan is to not sell anything and buy until I die. I would go along with that. And what my heirs do with it after that, you know, I can only hope. But I'll never know. I can set them up with the management. You know, I can show them how to do it. I can give them instructions, which I've written down detailed instructions of what to do. But it's only going to be as good as their efforts. But I think I'll feel better about that than if I was to sell everything and have the whole thing decimated by taxes. Because the heirs will get a step up in basis on everything. So really, the heirs, if they wanted to, the day after I died, they could sell everything. There'd be no income tax.
When you looked at this initially, I mean, were you thinking about legacy wealth? Was that the focus?
No, I never even wanted to have any kids or get married. but you know, your focus changes, and I ended up with four kids, and of course I married. So you know, now I have a little bit different outlook. But when I started out, it was just me, and I was only concerned with the present and having fun now. You know,
right. You know, we haven't really talked about this here on the show at all. I'm passionate about, though, which is the idea of mindset. And, you know, you can talk to somebody and you might not even see their house. You might not see their car. You might not know where they come from. But just in the conversation with that person, you can tell that that person isn't wealthy because of the way that they see the world. Either they think that things are out to get them or that they don't see big picture. Did you have a good understanding and sort of a broader scope of the world when you set out? Do you see the difference between yourself and maybe some, I don't know, wholesale investors that you work with or guys just starting out? Do you see maybe a scarcity mindset that they have? I'm curious to dive into some of the psychology of mindset because I think it's so important for people.
I agree. Even when I was starting out, I always have had this mindset that the world is full of opportunity and it doesn't matter what anybody else says, it's out there. I just have to find it. And I'm relentless. I do not give up on things I do. I start what I finish, generally speaking. And I do that in all facets of my life. Sometimes it's not even the best outcome because I'm tenacious about things. But in the area of investing, it's a good thing. If somebody says you can't do it, I don't ever believe that. I always keep looking for a way around it. You know, whatever comes my way, whatever's thrown at me, I'm always looking about how I can go around it, how I can get through it. Being tenacious and being what's the word? I forget the word where you never give up. You always persistent. That's the word. You've got to be persistent. If you feel like, well, it doesn't work here, it doesn't work for me, you're probably doing something wrong. You know, you have to keep searching and keep trying, keep failing. Don't be afraid to fail. You know, you've got to keep the fire going. Keep the mindset that there's opportunity and you're going to find it. You know,
have you failed?
Many times.
Did you give up from investing?
Bonehead mistakes, you know, big dollars. No, I didn't give up. I learned.
I hope everyone's paying attention to this. You know, I heard a quote the other day from Bob Proctor who said, you know, excellence is simply seeing something through to completion. That's it.
Yes.
Seeing something through to completion is excellence. And, you know, you learn from it at the end of it. You know, you either finish it, you look at it, and you say, oh, that was kind of crap. You know what? I'm going to learn from this. But I finished it and I learned something from it, and I'm going to take the next steps to go and do it another way the next time.
Right.
Well, Kim, it's been a real treat having you here on the show. New investors who are listening to this show, or maybe folks who own 5, 6, 7 properties and who are, you know, looking to take things to the next level. If they are really looking to take things to the next level, what advice would you give them? Either they're just starting out or they've got a few properties under their belt. What should they look for, you know, to you and your 140 properties? What sort of advice would you give them?
Stay hungry. Keep buying. Don't get lazy. Don't sit back on rest on your laurels. Always be looking for another house. Always be thinking about a better way to find a good deal. Always be looking to improve your management, to save on taxes. Do research, read books, listen to podcasts. All of this, you have to keep educated, and you have to be flexible because tax laws change, circumstances change, markets change, everything changes. You can't keep doing the same thing all the time. You've got to be flexible and learn new ways of doing things, new ways of advertising, like Zillow, for instance, didn't exist 10 years ago. Well, that's now how people rent houses usually. So you've got to be fast on your feet and willing to ride the tide and make changes when necessary.
Well, it's been a real treat, Kim, having you here on the show, diving in and talking about your strategies in rental real estate. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for spending the last 30, 40 minutes with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Clayton.
And you can reach out to us. Just simply go to the show notes page at morrisinvest.com/podcast. You can click on the show notes page and see everything we've been talking about here, including our Freedom Cheat Sheet, which is a 3-page download. It simply gets you in the right frame of mind. You can really backtrack and figure out what your monthly expenses are, figure out how many rental properties it would take to sort of live financially free just based on your monthly expenses, and then really start to wrap your head around doing some of the things that Kim was talking about in today's show. Thinking big, thinking abundance, don't think scarcity, and take things to the next level. So that Freedom Cheat Sheet is in the show notes page. Download it. It's totally free. Sit down with your wife, sit down with your husband, and dive into it and figure out where you need to be financially free. We'll see you back here on another episode of Investing in Real Estate. I'm Clayton Morris. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time, everyone.